Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2022 podcast series. This event was proudly supported by the Department of Environment, Land, Water and Planning.
Okay, welcome everybody. Thanks for coming along. I was about to say this morning, but it's actually midday, so that makes it difficult, doesn't it? This is the session called Hope versus the Climate Crisis, and my name is Mickey Perkins. I'm the Environment and Climate Reporter at The Age. I'm going to start by respectfully acknowledging that we are today meeting in Naam, also known as Melbourne, on the lands of the Kulin Nations, in particularly the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people. They are the original custodians of this land. We pay our respects to their elders past and present, and we pay respects to all other First Nations people here today. This was stolen land. It was never ceded, and it always was, and it always will be Aboriginal land. Okay, so today promises to be a very interesting conversation. It feels like there's a real urgency now in our push to try and decarbonise as we approach 2030, which, as many of you would know, is sort of, I guess, a marker around temperature change. And it's also a very overwhelming and terrifying time for many people. And I think one of the reasons that it's so great the Writers' Festival has brought us all here today is to talk that through with experts and maybe think about some hopeful or at least pragmatic ways we can respond to the climate crisis. You know, you may not identify with the word hope. It's not actually one that I use, but I think it'll be interesting to find out from our guests where they seek solace and action when they think about the climate emergency. So I'm going to introduce our panellists, and then they're all going to... I'll ask them a few questions each and we'll have a chat. I welcome, you know, them questioning each other if they'd like to do that, so let's make it an easy conversation. And at the end, there'll be an opportunity for you guys to ask a question or, you know, ask one of the panellists what they think about something. So please have a think about that as we're going and try and come up with something interesting and maybe personal if you want it to be. So first of all, on my left here, I have First Nations environmental justice campaigner Toshiko King, who's happy for me to call her Tish. Tish hails from the island of Masig in the Torres Strait. The Torres Strait is also known as Zenadith Kes. Tish has studied ocean science, worked on campaigns with the Seed Indigenous Youth Climate Network, and is one of the founders of a campaign called Our Islands, Our Home, which is a grassroots campaign that originated in the Torres Strait around climate action. Tish also went to the COP26 summit in Glasgow last year, and she brings a very unique perspective and one we're very lucky to have with us here today. I have been to the Torres Strait to look at sea level rise, and Tish can talk about that from a sort of first-person perspective, which is, you know, so unique and special. So thank you for coming, Tish. We also have award-winning climate scientist and writer Joelle Gerges, who works at the Australian National University. She served as a lead author for the IPCC Sixth Assessment Report, which we're going to talk about more in a little bit if you're not sure what that is. She's also the author of a new book called Humanity's Moment, A Climate Scientist's Case for Hope. So we all want that. We all want to know what Joelle's going to tell us. And she brings expert and very personal insights to the environmental crisis we find ourselves in. And I, having read her book this week, am also grateful to her for bringing all those threads together for the rest of us. And also we have award-winning writer, historian and commentator Jeff Sparrow. If you're from Melbourne, you're probably, some of you are familiar with Jeff's work. He's been working in this space for a long time. He works at Melbourne University, and his current book is Crime Against Nature, Capitalism and Global Heating. So this offers a counter-argument to the idea that we're all to blame for global warming. Everyone should feel guilty about global warming. He turns the spotlight on the culpability of corporations and capitalism in causing the climate crisis, and also talks about solutions that we could draw from environmental actions through history. So this is a very useful perspective, and I find quite a hopeful one. So I might start with you, Tish. A lot of people in this audience probably haven't been to the Torres Strait, although I would urge them to go. So can you paint a picture of your island, Masig, what it's like and what life is there like there, and also some of the changes that your people are seeing over the last few decades?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you very much for having me here. Sorry, I'm like trying to figure out Mike. Now, I just want to start off with just acknowledging country in my language. And so, Kulai Kid Nailak Essa Poi Bun, Nalman Koi Agath, Nud Muruzapu I Mithin, Alak Nalpunka Poi Bun, Kapakut Mittamukka Murabuai, A Mura Mabigal Nu, Nuzunel Tish. Nai kuka lug, masignu napa kuka gal zendeth kesnu esel. And so I would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the Kulin kinship of the land, seas, skies and water where we gather here today. I would like to acknowledge their elders past and present and for the emerging leaders right across this nation. And just as we're here talking it and having this conversation, I pay homage and respects to the many footprints before us and their contributions to climate justice, culture and protecting country. And so can I get some spirit fingers from the audience of who has heard of the Torres Straits? Yes. That's nice, thank you. Who has been to the Torres Straits? Yes, to those folks. But who knows some really deadly Torres Strait Islander leaders like Bala Paddy Mills, Eddie Mabo, Koike Ate. Yes, me. Nah. And so, you know, I really want to share and start off by starting of as a Kukagal woman, which is the Central Island group. It's a Coral Cay island group. So it's like Bora Bora, across Jamaica, across like the Maldives, all in one, and with like beautiful coconut trees everywhere. And the island that I come from, Musig, has six different types of coconut trees, all for different uses. And that was actually something that I learned just recently when I went back. But I wanted to start off by sharing that when I was a young kid, I used to live in the back of Thursday Island, and my Athe Jack used to share to me and look across the ocean and share about how our stories and our connections to the ocean is more than just going and fishing. It was about, he was a pearl lugger and worked on the boats as a pearl diver, and so would share that the stars were our navigation and that our bird species would tell us when to go to closer to land, like the frigate bird, which is one of my sky totems. And so it was through those stories have I've always grown up knowing that as an island woman, I'm a saltwater woman and have those deep connections, you know, through not just my blood, but through the land and sea that we, you know, work in and around. And, you know, through this, I really understood, you know, the importance of culture and that responsibility of being able to share to my brothers and sisters, to the next generation about, you know, about it. But climate change is real, and it's something that is probably for some folks a new conversation, but for me, something that I have been dealing since, well, my community, since colonization. But, you know, our communities are feeling it where it's impacting the lives and our well-being, you know, from the bushfires, from our droughts, you know, from flash flooding and from sea levels rising like those in the Torres Straits. You know, all of our lives are at risk. But it's communities like mine, like Musig, like the Torres Strait Islands that don't actually contribute to our national and global emissions, yet we are disproportionately impacted and hit first and worst. And, you know, this is probably something that you, Joelle, will speak on further, but a key indicator, you know, science and research have, you know, illustrated that a key primary driver is fossil fuel emissions from coal, oil and gas. And it's, you know, when we look at that and those disproportionate impacts, you know, it feels unjust. And so right now, You know, after the bushfires, I had to go, I went up to Musik and had to pick up the bones of my ancestors from I guess, the warming of the atmosphere being exacerbating natural events like king tides and advancing seas that actually ripped the burial grounds of sacred sites. And for me, this is it. I don't have words yet. And so, you know, I think just to, as we, you know, in this time, just understanding, I guess, what that justice is and, you know, and those frontline communities that have been impacted.
So, I mean, thank you for sharing that with us. It's a huge, and I can understand why you haven't got the words for that yet, but I think it's really important for this audience so far away to understand that Australians in many different ways are experiencing the climate crisis, and this is one of them.
Absolutely.
And I was going to ask you about the campaign, the Your Island's Your Home campaign, because this is a grassroots response that's come from these experiences, isn't it? Like, what do you do when these things are happening? Well, you organise.
Absolutely. I think that's something that everyone in the room probably may have come in. It's like, you know, we've seen decades of missed opportunities from our leaders to really lead in this country. And so it's been people power that have actually come together to support community. And we recently saw that through the floods in the beginning of the year. We saw that through the bushfires. And I think, you know, for me, this is something that, you know, I also always feel proud of, is that our community is always coming together to share their story and amplify, you know, maybe not their vulnerability, but their strength and resilience. And so it's, you know, Our Islands Are Home, for those that probably don't know about it, is a really incredible campaign that came from 8 claimants from different islands to stand up and started having the conversation as, well, this is wrong. Like, these, you know, these rising seas and, you know, inundation is impacting the way that we live, where we are having trouble to access fresh water. We are, you know, having trouble to access our food from our oceans bleaching. We are having trouble accessing fresh food and hunt and using our practices to get there and to be able to do that and pass that on. And so, you know, this campaign has been, you know, they went to the United Nations Human Rights Committee, and then the Morrison government accused the government for not reducing their emissions by 1.5 degrees. And so it's been a way that through this time, through COVID, you know, be able to share their story, you know, through this space. And I think, you know, from the last 3 years and seeing a lot of injustices, we also for community, for everyone here, that we saw like our last government, you know, not sign up and be a part of ending coal. And, you know, we're one of like, what, 7 nations to not. And so I think this is like, you know, this campaign has been able to really push and make governments and corporations just accountable for the actions and then look at who's impacted and who are on the front lines. Mm.
I might come back to you at
too
the
easy.
End. That's okay.
I've been yarning so much. I'm sorry.
No, it's been fantastic, and we'll come back, and I'm sure the audience will have questions as well. Joelle, you were one of the lead authors of the IPCC, most recent IPCC report. Most people in the room have probably heard of the IPCC, but if they haven't, could you talk about this UN body that was created to try and assess the science on climate change?
Yes, of course. So the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is this UN group that gets together every 7 years to effectively distill an understanding of the state of the global climate system. And it's a really thorough deep dive into how all the different components of the Earth system are changing. So it is a really rigorous process. Governments of the world put forward 1,000 different nominations in terms of the scientists to be involved in that study, and that about 240 are selected from 66 different countries around the world. I was selected as one of the 12 from here in Australia, and effectively we're providing our expertise to this process to effectively just get a sense of, well, how is the world changing? Why is it changing? And just listening to Tish, actually, it's just so important to have a really clear sense that we're not just talking about numbers on a graph here. We're talking about the people and places that we love. And we're talking about culture. And we're talking about the loss of things that are irreplaceable. And so as Tish was also speaking, I was just thinking how, I mean, the IPCC is there to give us a really cold, hard look at the facts, how the world is changing. So right now, 250 million people live within 2 metres of sea level. And as the century progresses, we're looking at the exposure of over 1 billion people by the middle of the century. So in terms of what that means for people on the ground, you really are talking about the displacement of people en masse in terms of hundreds of millions of people not being able to live in the way that they have in the past. But what that means is that it just changes the whole stability, if you like, of the planet, because it's not just about the physical components of climate change, and I'm happy to talk more about where we're headed, but I think it's really important that we realise that when we do talk about this sort of thing, that we are talking about people here. And a bit closer to home, everyone here in the room knows that we had the Black Summer bushfires in 2019, 2020, and we saw 25% of Australia's temperate forests burn in a single bushfire season. We saw 3 billion animals either killed or displaced, and the koala, our most iconic mammal, is now an endangered species on the East Coast. I mean, that's an extraordinary thing to really allow to sink into your mind. And just in terms of other impacts we've seen in recent years, we've seen about 50% of the Great Barrier Reef die off since 2015, 2016. And so we're seeing this large-scale ecosystem collapse. We're seeing it in our seas, we're seeing it on land, we're seeing it everywhere. We're seeing it in our ice sheets. And so I guess the reason why I'm here is really as a member of the scientific community trying to really convey the sense of urgency that's there. So right now, our current emissions trajectory has us breaching 1.5 degrees of global warming in the early 2030s. That's within a decade. So what that means for the low-lying parts of the world is effectively the displacement of a lot of people. And not just that, it's also thinking about, so right now we've experienced 1.2 degrees of global warming, so what are we going to see with 1.5, with 2, with 3, with 4? That's something we need to think about. That's something that the general community really has to understand, that right now we're nowhere near being on track where we need to be. So the current emission pledges that have been implemented see us warming between 2 and 4 degrees. That's a catastrophic overshoot of the Paris Agreement targets. And even with the net zero emission pledges that have been put forward at the last UN climate conference in Glasgow, COP26, that still sees us warm about 2 degrees. At 2 degrees, you're really looking at the decimation of coral reef ecosystems, effectively 99% of coral reefs collapse. And coral reef ecosystems also support about 25% of marine life in terms of different stages of their life cycle. So we are talking about really fundamental changes to the way that the Earth system works. And so from the perspective of being a scientist who was involved at that UN level, and really seeing all these different parts of the jigsaw puzzle placed together, I think that's really was the motivation for me writing my book, because I don't think it's enough for the scientific community to sit with this knowledge. I feel it's really important that we start to really truly understand the gravity of the moment we're in right now, and that this decade really is critical in terms of turning it around. Before I move on, the last thing I wanted to say was just by way of introduction, is that one of the key messages in the IPCC's assessment report is how bad we let things get is still very much in our hands. So this concept that we're this idea that we are experiencing runaway climate change or it's all too late, that's a really unhelpful way of thinking about it. And that sometimes those ideas come from non-expert commentators. So I guess that's why a scientist like me has decided to try and write a book to try and convey what the scientific community understands about the issue so that we can just have a clear-eyed look at things. Because the truth is bad enough, to be honest. We don't need to exaggerate things. We don't need to sensationalise. But I think once we have that grounding of where we are, then we can start to move forward with a more appropriate response.
Yeah, I was aware as you were speaking, I could sort of sense that slight panic in myself, because everything you say is true, but it's also terrifying. And I think that secondary message around the fact that it's not too late, there is so much that needs to be done, but it's still possible to try and keep warming to 1.5 or only slightly above that, should be a motivator rather than something that terrifies people. But I guess the one, what I wanted to ask you, and I just wanted to assure the audience that we're going to come back to ideas around hope and future trajectories by the end of this talk. It's not all going to be terrifying and doom and gloom, because I'm sure that most of you are kind of across the science. You understand it, you believe it. It's not, you don't need to be convinced. But it's also important to have a clear-eyed look at things, so we're doing that. Maybe we could talk about the personal toll that some of this has taken on people like yourself. And at the end, I'll come back to all of you and talk about hopeful pathways or pragmatic pathways or how you see things. So I'm just going to reassure the crowd of that. But yeah, Joelle, you wrote a very honest account of how you experienced those late night, long, rigorous, endless sessions as an IPCC volunteer. It's a voluntary thing on top of what she already does. So, you know, thank you for your work. And you also talked about the mental health effects of that, the anxiety that you felt around that. People refer to it as eco-anxiety sometimes. Can you, yeah, just talk about the effect it has on a personal level for someone in your position?
Yeah, I think it is important because I think we need to start to have some language around, I think, these collective feelings that many of us are feeling. And certainly as a professional research scientist, I mean, I'm in front of a lot of really confronting material every day. And I think the IPCC experience for me was really seeing the planetary scale all in one hit. So when you work at that UN level, it's not just I'm looking at Australia, I'm looking at the entire world. And I think when I saw that, it was just something you couldn't run away from, really. It was just so clear. And as I was working on this report, all those extreme events that I just outlined, like the Black Summer and the catastrophic flooding of the East Coast, also were just playing out. And for me, I guess there was this sort of collision between my personal and professional life where I felt like it was sort of disingenuous to pretend that I wasn't having an emotional response to the work I was in front of. And I think that the more I would talk to my colleagues, they'd confess that, yeah, actually, this is really stressful. Or talking to people, for instance, who work at the Bureau of Meteorology in the lead up to the Black Summer bushfires, and saying, I'm terrified by the forecast. I've never put out a forecast like this before. And so the people on the front line know that the world is changing, and it's something that I think we have to be honest about, because if the people who know the most about it aren't alarmed, then how can we expect the average person who's just getting on with daily life to not have sort of an appropriate emotional response? And I think that ultimately, I made a decision in this book, which was a difficult decision, to share my personal response, because I felt that until we really start to care about this in a way that moves us emotionally, then this isn't going to change. Unless this starts to be a cultural conversation about our values, about what it is to be human at this moment in time, then this is not going to go anywhere, because ultimately we will start to protect things that we love. And so when I mentioned before, talking about, say, the loss of the koala or the loss of cultures, I mean, if you let that sink in, that is actually something that can be profoundly transformative, and then it can be a source of fuel to think about what you can do in whatever sphere of influence you have. But I can assure you the scientific community are only just a part of this puzzle, and that there's a lot of wisdom and a lot of knowledge and a lot of motivation out there, and I think it's about telling these better stories so that it isn't just doom and gloom, although I must say as a scientist we have to be very clear about the reality, so that's unfortunately my role, so don't shoot the messenger. But it's one of these things that we just have to be real about that. But moving on from that place, I think it is a really inclusive conversation, and it's actually this pivotal moment in human history that we can all step up to, so I think that is a really motivating concept.
Jeff, I might bring you in here as well. So Crimes Against Nature is a collection of essays on capitalism and global heating, and they're all on different topics, things like electric vehicles and industrialisation. But you always tell the stories through historic and tangible examples, which I really appreciated as a reader. There was one that made me sort of laugh in a sad way, that around Lucky Strike wanting to get women to smoke cigarettes. So apparently the green packaging wasn't attractive to women at that time. This was in the 30s, I think, 30s and 40s. And so they had a huge PR campaign to host a charity ball where all the women wore green. Vogue wrote stories about it, the newspapers wrote stories about it, and before you know, green is a new colour and we're all smoking cigarettes outside in public. The reason I raised this as an example is I thought it was so interesting how you talked about the way that corporations have used their power and influence, whether it be through PR or you know, the markets or wherever, to keep their capital going, to keep making money and to greenwash their activities. And you're showing the historical examples of that, as well as the contemporary ones. So can you talk about the role that capitalism plays in the current environment crisis? Big question, just, you know, sure, just sure. That question.
So The Guardian did a bit a few months back calculating that the biggest fossil fuel companies had $900 billion invested in new gas and oil production by the year 2030. So this is essentially betting on humanity to fail. At the same time, I think the most recent figures on government subsidies to fossil fuel companies amounts to $700 billion each and every year, right? So you hear those statistics and it's pretty clear who is to blame and what needs to be done to stop this. Now, these corporations that have invested nearly $1 trillion in humanity overshooting the IPCC's targets are not going to take that lying down, right? So that's a lot of money, that's a lot of power. The old strategy of climate denial no longer works. A third of Pakistan is currently underwater. There's massive heat waves around all around the world. Denial doesn't cut it anymore. But they've developed a whole series of other strategies that in many ways are far more effective. And one of the most insidious, I think, is to convince people that corporations are not to blame. You are to blame. The corporations might be digging up coal or oil, but they're doing it because you're lazy and greedy and you want all this stuff and the corporations are just servicing you. And as soon as you embrace that, then of course you can't blame the corporations. You should start thinking about yourself. Why aren't you riding a bicycle? Why don't you have a keep cup? Why aren't you taking out your recycling? And it's paralyzing. And so one of the things I try to do in the book is to show the process by which corporations created this demand. One of the really clear examples, I think, is around the proliferation of plastics that takes place after the end of the Second World War. There are almost none of the uses of modern plastics that were demanded by ordinary consumers. And almost every example, the corporations had to overcome massive resistance from the public before they could normalise things like plastic bags or disposable cups or whatever. And they did this not to serve people, they did this to make huge profits, which led to massive environmental destruction. So, for instance, we always hear about plastic bags in supermarkets, and the way the story is presented to us is the supermarkets are trying to phase out these plastic bags, but you lazy, greedy people want them all the time. Actually, if you look back historically, when they tried to introduce plastic bags into the supermarket, there was mass resistance to it. People hated it. There was a Ban the Bags campaign all across the United States. And even when people started using them, they were doing things like they were hanging them out on their line to dry because they were accustomed to recycling things. It was just what people did. And the corporations ran a huge PR campaign to normalise plastic and also to normalise disposability. So not only do you have a plastic bag, but you throw it away at the end. And more effectively, they made it so that it was almost impossible to avoid disposable goods. It was almost impossible to avoid plastic. Once upon a time, you could go to the supermarket, you could bring your Hessian sack and you could fill it up with coffee beans. You can't do that anymore. Our cities have been redesigned. It's almost impossible to live without a car. And once those conditions have been changed, it's absolutely pointless people blaming themselves for the conditions in which they've been put. Not only is it entirely ineffective, but it's demoralizing, it's demobilizing. If we all feel that we're guilty, if we all feel that it's our fault, if we all feel that humanity is a plague that is destroying the earth, we will tune out and we will allow this to happen. And so it's incredibly important, I think, that we identify who is to blame and start thinking about how we can stop them. Mm.
I'm going to ask you all to think about the term hope and tell me whether or not it's a term that you use, that you find useful in terms of thinking about climate. And then maybe we'll come back and talk about action after that. So whoever wants to start. Joelle, would you like to go first?
Yeah, I was just thinking about something Jeff was saying. It was just sort of quite thought-provoking. But again, it's the social license that either is given or removed for these things. And I think this sort of feeds into hope. And this is where we have agency. Because if we actually say culturally we're not okay with that, then that becomes something that you can shift the social norm. And when I started to read about this sort of material for the researching of my book, I found that about you only need about 25% of the population to actually shift a social norm, and then other people follow suit. And to me, that's hopeful. It just goes to show you don't need everyone. It's a critical mass, but it's also, are we going to make a decision collectively that we are going to remove the social license for these corporate polluters to continue to cook the planet? This is the point we're at now. We just need to call it straight and say, this is really the moment we're in. And I think in terms of hope, the Australian federal election for me was a turning point where we removed the social license for this abhorrent government to effectively continue to do this. I mean, we still have a long way to go, and there's a lot to say on that particular point, but really what I do want to say is that when we vote for people that reflect our values, then you can see the social and political change. And to me, that's hopeful. That's actually real hope. That's something that is not just the keep cup or the plastic bag and that kind of thing, although it is important. I must say those individual actions are important, but it pales in comparison when we're actually talking about the corporations that continue to exploit fossil fuels. So from the perspective of just thinking about hope, I mean, I take hope in realising that this struggle for social justice is the human story. This is something that the entirety of human history is made up of this, whether it's the civil rights movement or gender equality. The climate justice movement right now is just the latest in a long line. And it's not a done deal. It's going to be something that's going to be intergenerational, but we have to shift the needle. And this is where the cultural change comes about. But this is also, for me, where the hope comes about, because since time immemorial, humans have risen to these challenges. We only have to look through our history. And so what we need to do right now is step up and say, how do I want to show up in this moment? What do I want to do with the time that I have on this planet to make the world a better place? Now, it's a profound moment, and I think that when we start to frame this as more of a social and cultural issue, not just talking about energy, complex energy policy and all this sort of stuff, then I think it's a really different kind of conversation we're having. And maybe Tish has something to say on that, but I guess from the perspective of hope, I'm holding on to it.
What about you, Tish?
Taking that all in, but I think, so for me, it wasn't a word that I used, and that seems really, like, grim of me, but I think talking from what, you know, you just shared, Jeff, like, for the last 3 years, I've been working on a campaign for no fracking in the NT from corporations like that, and one of those corporations has just been fined for polluting waterways in Queensland, and so it's just like, you know, that's what we need for gas, and then the blame people that we use that gas. And so it's just like really shifting that. So sorry, just taking that. And I'm like, prior to the election, I did not feel hope. But I think May 21st, like I was, I was up in Cape York, really shifting out to turn out the vote with First Nations communities. So driving out for, 3 hours just to, pop up, go door to door, bring the mob out, turn out the vote, and really shift the way, leadership is in that electorate, and change the stories and share the stories. And so I was in the pub in Bamaga. I don't know if any of you know MPA, with the tavern with the uncles, and it was just like we're drinking water. But it was just so exciting to get community. We're excited and we're talking about this for the first time in such a long time about doing real action to really shift the story and to amplify their voices. And so when that decision came, after we saw that there was a majority, for Labor, I slept for the first time that night. And then as we continue to roll out and hear, more news from the election, it came out that there are more First Nations people in Parliament than ever. Mm. And so when I look at someone who's been raised with real systemic injustices, where, I could have been locked up as a kid, our children are still being taken away, there's disparities in education, I just was like, wow, yes, our voices are there. We have leaders from community who are there. And that was hopeful. And since then, we've been able to have conversations and build on, build relationships with new leadership to really continue to share this urgency. And I think when you were just talking about, degrees and those differences, I always just think, what climate action is vastly different to climate justice, and what 1.5 degrees could mean a fighting chance and 2 degrees could mean the end. And for me, it's, it's you who wields the power of that. Mm-hmm. And so we really need to, in these conversations, having more of that, I feel that hope and, being able to share my story and having this amazing crowd here, I was just like, this is just feeling more hopeful to be able to continue to share story. And I think, that ground culmination of people power, that's what's hopeful.
Thank you. And Jeff, what about you? Is it a word that you identify with much?
Because I think if you write journalism on this topic, as you would know, you're always under pressure to be hopeful. And I think often what people mean by that is they want the article to end reassuring them that everything is going to be okay. And I am quite resistant to that because I think things are going to get pretty difficult. I mean, one of the things that climate does is it acts as a crisis intensifier. It overwhelmingly impacts first and foremost the poorest and most oppressed, whether it's in other countries or whether it's within Australia. You only have to think of the consequences of the bushfires and the floods, and the people who were affected by those, they weren't the wealthy people. They were people who were living on the, the flood-prone areas, or the people who are living in rural areas who were most affected by the fire. So I think that we have to brace ourselves for what is coming. And in that respect, in some ways, I would prefer less hope and more rage. But that being said, the notion that we can't do anything, the notion that we have to live like this and we have to be committed to a system that is destroying everything we hold dear seems to me a profound slander on humanity, to say that we are not capable of something better than this. And I like the idea of humanity's moment, because one of the things that inspires me is that we collectively now face a challenge to save almost everything that's good in the planet in the face of almost everything that's bad. So, addressing the climate crisis means social justice. It means, reforming every aspect of our society. That is a good thing, and that's something that we need to do collectively together, and that can be inspiring, I think.
Mm. I just wanted to share something. This was a quote I saw online yesterday by Georgina Wood, who's a poet and environmentalist who lives in New South Wales, and she's written a piece. And it just really jumped out at me because I personally don't really think about the term hope much, but I really liked her framing. She says, "What sustains me is not hope but love. Love is a motivation that transcends circumstance. It transcends technocratic and political arguments about whether it is still possible to prevent catastrophic climate change. Love of the rich and varied world of evolutionary biology, love of people and their myriad cultural and communal expressions is a motivator that will last long after vain hope is extinguished. It can motivate action even from despair." So that was something that I read, and I just thought I'd bring that along to the group. Just before we go to questions from the audience, I wanted to ask, you know, briefly all of you to talk about what you would say in terms of action. Where do people who hear this stuff and think, oh my God, where do I start? Where do they channel their energy and action? Recommendations, Tish?
So many. I was just like, whoa, where to start? I think importantly is where I'm now, I'm with a giving platform called Groundswell Giving. And, you know, with being moving from like campaigning and organizing, but understand grassroots communities and grassroots groups, like not just First Nations, but right across this nation that are doing the work, that have been advocating and campaigning and doing the political shifting. There is 0.5% of funding goes to climate advocacy in this country. And so a one way where we can come together and is a tangible solution is actually funding it. You know, I love that, you know, we are a giving circle that brings all people together. And so one way that we can be able to, you know, have First Nations justice that is, you know, to have climate justice is those tangible solutions. And we need to have First Nations people or those experts leading and to be able to fund their work. And so I say fund that. I reckon definitely if you're not following First Nations-led organisations like Seed Indigenous Youth Climate Network or Our Islands Are Home, the decision for the UN case is going to be coming in the next few weeks. And so I think that'll be really interesting because it's the first of its kind in the world and will be able to set precedents for other First Nations people. I'll leave it there. There's probably loads and I'll share later, but I'll pass it to you, Joelle.
Yeah, okay. Thanks, that was great. I guess having just written my new book, which is called Humanity's Moment, A Climate Scientist's Case for Hope, I've poured in all my ideas about what I think people could do. But maybe just to distill it down is just really starting to reframe your thinking about the moment we're in right now. Of realising that we might look back at the 2020s as this really pivotal moment where we shifted things. The same way we look at the 1960s as this really revolutionary time. We're living in this right now. And you want to stop and think about how you're going to look back at this moment, maybe talking to your grandkids or future generations, and how did you show up? So I would encourage people. I mean, there's the obvious things of, you know, how you exercise your power as a consumer and as a, you know, in terms of your vote and all those sorts of things. But I guess I'm taking one step beyond that and thinking about reframing it in your own mind that we're actually in this regenerative opportunity where it doesn't have to be this inevitable apocalyptic future, that we actually can be the creators of this new era that we live in. And that's why this book is called Humanity's Moment, because it's our moment to step up, to right the wrongs of the past, to really heal our relationship with each other in the natural world. It's a profound moment. So I think if we stop and we think about it from the perspective of looking back, because right now it's history in the making, we're in it. So it's hard. And so we're going to win some battles and we're going to lose some battles. And it's going to be something that is not a done deal. It's going to be intergenerational. But to me, that is a meaningful endeavour and something we can all be a part of in small and in big ways.
If I could make three suggestions, they would be organise, organise and organise. Mm. That there are no strictly individual solutions to this crisis. We need profound structural social and economic change, and that will only happen if we unite with other people. So find some kind of organisation, join your trade union, find a community group, get involved in the next climate strike. By doing that, we create the basis for social change. It's only when we come together we have the power that we can exert against these corporations and governments. But at the same time, when you come together with other people, you will feel more hopeful. You will feel a sense of collective power. You won't feel this atomized, isolated person confronting this existential problem. And so I think that it's not only a political solution, but it's also a personal response. It makes you feel much better the moment you sense that you're actually part of this humanity's moment. I think I really like that idea of saying, okay, this is a key historical turning point, and we all have to ask ourselves, what are we doing? And when we ask ourselves that, that's a collective question. It's not a question of whether I did the right thing morally as an individual. It's a question of how we organise to fight back. So organise.
I think that's a really good point, actually, Jeff, because there are so many fantastic groups doing good work. You don't need to go and reinvent the wheel. You can go and lend your energy and time to them. Yeah, because I think, you know, if you think, oh, God, I've got to start off some new initiative and build from the ground up, like, no, there are so many people out there who just would welcome the support in all the ways you can offer it, whether it be financial, time, energy, whatever. I'm going to just get everyone to, first of all, clap, because I think these guys have done an amazing job. Thank you. And now is the time, if anyone has a question, to ask it. There might be a microphone, but we also might not need one.
Thanks very much. Thank you for taking my question. This is a question to all the panel. I am a member of the Law Council of Australia's Climate Change Working Group and the Deputy Chair of the National Environmental Law Group of the Law Council of Australia. The biggest problem I face in those roles, and lawyers are writers, they're advocates, and they're persons who are not without influence. The biggest problem that I face is my colleagues are completely over it. We, for example, are on our fourth submission to the Senate inquiry into faunal extinction, where we're saying the same thing over and over. Waste recycle, barrier reef, Indigenous issues. We have our submissions go up. People come from, experts from all over Australia come to Canberra. They sit there, talk, and then our recommendations are accepted. They go into the report and nothing happens until about a year or two later, there's a further inquiry into almost exactly the same thing, and we wheel out the same old stuff, updated and revised with recent cases and test cases of the kind you're referring to. My colleagues are sick of it. They're so totally sick of it.
That's a question about
now, what I'd like to just ask is the role you're calling on us to be active, and we're around that. What's the role you think lawyers can usefully play?
I might take that one. I hear your frustration, firstly. I mean, it is extremely difficult. I've got colleagues, senior colleagues, who've been involved in the IPCC assessment report since its first days in 1990. The climate scientists understand when people aren't listening. So I guess I would like to say that we share your frustration. But it's like a battering ram. We just have to keep going. It is intensely frustrating, but we can't give up. And eventually, we're going to break through this. And so, I mean, I hope that's helpful, that I feel like at least it's got to happen. It's got to happen. And I think change comes from within as well. And it's around awareness. It's around getting behind the people who are going to take those stands to make those structural changes, that some of the stuff that Jeff's touched on as well. But this is massive. This is not going to happen overnight. But we also can't just lose hope. And I mean, you know, if you're frustrated, maybe step away and come back. But I think this is really where the rubber hits the road. We're going through this transformative period, but it isn't going to happen overnight.
There was a question at the back on the left there.
Thanks. Hi, firstly, thanks for all your work. I know it's really hard work you're doing, so thanks a lot. I work in activism as a sort of communicator and at a cultural level, but also in trying to accelerate corporate change. And I think there's a really interesting tension in the title of today's topic, you know, hope versus the climate crisis. I think there's this sense of not wanting to freak people out more than they're already freaked out, particularly in the corporate class. But I feel like we're still, as a society, yet to get our heads around the true extent of you know, the scenario projections that you know, the IPCC reports and the like predict the sort of 2040, 2050 scenario of, you know, 1 billion climate refugees, 2 billion people with no access to water, collapsed food, you know, and then all of the geopolitical strife that comes with that. Do you feel that we need to go even further and actually prosecute those sort of, you know, make it plain what we're facing? It's not just what we're facing now, but it's going to get so much worse. Obviously, we need hope at the tail of that, because otherwise it just shuts people down. But do you feel like we haven't gone far enough with that conversation, or do you think we've covered it well?
As a scientist on the panel, maybe I'll take this one quickly, and then I don't know if others want to comment. But part of what I do in my book is outline in really simple and clear terms the planetary situation we're in, looking at the different projections, the different pathways. I still think that the average person doesn't really grasp the gravity of how bad it is, and it is going to get worse before it gets better. So while we need to be really realistic about where we are right now, we then also need to move on to what do we do about it. Just like an emergency situation, we need to understand the nuts and bolts of where we are. That I still feel isn't really well appreciated in the broader community. But I think from that point, then we can start to think about how we start to shift our social and political systems.
I also think it's really important to recognise that we're at a moment now where most of the political class recognise they can't just pretend the crisis isn't happening, and so the strategy to which the strategy that they're employing is much more to do with misdirection. And I think it's we really have to hold their feet to the fire. So, you know, we're in a situation now where after the federal election, we're being told the climate wars are over. Because people want hope, everyone wants to take a sigh of relief, so everything's going to be okay. Well, at the same time, you know, the federal government is opening up vast areas for fossil fuel exploration. Tanya Plibersek says that the way we're going to respond to the biodiversity crisis is we're going to create a Wall Street for nature by marketizing biodiversity and setting up a version of an emissions trading system for biodiversity. These are catastrophic ideas. Catastrophic, going 100% in the wrong direction. And just because they're coming from people who pay lip service to the environmental emergency doesn't make them any better. So I think we really have to be firm. We need action now. We don't need promises. We don't need fancy speeches. We don't need, you know, parliamentary days where we all wear funny hats or whatever. We need things to actually start happening.
Question from this side of the room. Maybe next to you on the left, and then we'll come down here.
Thank you. Thanks for a great discussion. I just was wondering what you're thinking around the role of the mainstream is, because I've been involved in activism previously and felt that while the ideal, or I guess what we were hoping to head towards, was a kind of mainstream, like reaching the mainstream, really what it felt to me was that we were just heading more into an echo chamber. And I think the previous speaker spoke to the problem, which is that the people who are open to the science can't feel it emotionally because they have to protect themselves. And so I'm just wondering how mainstream you think we need to, like what's the reach that we need to get to before we can really see this action, the serious action?
Tish, do you want to have a go at that one? I mean, I don't want to hog all the time, so Tish, do you want to?
You go first, that's fine.
I think this connection between the head and the heart is really important, and it's something that I use as a frame in my book because I think until people do feel that this is really about the people and places we love, then we're not going to get the response that we need. So in terms of mainstreaming it, again, you just need a critical mass of people to shift a social norm. And again, it's about this sort of creation or removal of a social license around these things. And so I feel like we're at the beginnings of this movement, but it's a global movement. It is out there. But in terms of, you know, mainstreaming that into Australian society, then, you know, we have to start to think about the things that we value culturally and turning this into a cultural conversation. Do we value a Great Barrier Reef? Do we value a livable future? These are the sorts of conversations we need to start to have, but I thought Tish might have something to say about the grassroots.
Yeah, I think, like, I mean, there's so many nuances now, like, with it, and about, like, I guess mainstreaming, because there's so many people just impacted differently. But, you know, when building movements and grassroots organizing and sharing messages, is that through, like, I guess just talking, like, true telling, and I think that's a big thing about that, you know, connection of First Nations justice. But, you know, we all experienced through COVID being locked down, and especially if you're based here on Naam, you know, we had lockout laws and we had, you know, had to only can go out for an hour. But, you know, through that, we all kind of gravitated to somewhere, like, in the natural world, right? How many people go to the mountains and go hiking, snowboarding and skiing? How many people go on the, you know, go down to the beaches? It's those, what you're saying, those places that you love, that you feel connected to, may not be there anymore. And for us, for First Nations, it's on that large scale. But I guess, you know, when you're trying to shift corporations and, like, people in those spaces, I guess it's that, you know, finding that shared value and then having that sense of them sharing that sense of urgency together. And look, it is difficult. It's not easy. And I think coming back from, like, in the last, since post-election, I've been in rooms with corporations like Microsoft, Nike, like, you know, different types of spaces that want to shift into that. But hearing, like, from this lady at the front about, like, corporations that have, when you to shift, like, you know, inquiries and, like, getting knocked back all the time, it's defeating. Mm. But, you know, in this space, we must continue because we have to stand shoulder to shoulder in this fight for a livable future for us and the next generation, and especially for young people. I've now become, again, youth adjacent, but it's, you know, it's young people that are ones that are going to foot the bill. We're inheriting the consequences and these responsibilities, and so we really need to shift the way and start sparking these conversations.
I might jump on this one too, because when I think of mainstreaming and I think of the social change we need around climate, one of the examples that comes to my mind is the tremendous changes that have had around sexuality and gender over the last, you know, few decades, so much so that the cultural landscape now is almost unimaginable compared to when I was at school. I'm sure most of you will have the same experience. So that is a social movement that is now impeccably mainstream. You know, every country town is now much more open to different sexual identities than it was 10 or 15 years ago. But, you know, where did the modern movement for gay liberation begin? It began outside the Stonewall nightclub in New York in 1969 with a bunch of drag queens and sex workers fighting back against homophobic police. And I think it's a good example that we need a mainstream movement, we need a mass movement, but that's not counterposed to small numbers of ordinary people taking stances that are quite unpopular at the moment, because they can have snowballing effects.
There was lots of questions. So there was a woman down here, or a person down here, sorry, with the mask on.
I'll take it off so you can hear me a bit better. Thank you once again for all your insight. Taking on Jeff's point about we need structural, economic and societal change, I think we saw that with COVID. You know, everything was completely turned on its head and we saw the world change in a second overnight. What can we learn from COVID to address the climate crisis? Do you think that, you know, we're going to see any action because of COVID, or do we think people just want to forget about what happened in the last 2 years?
It's a great point. I think it just shows that the world can mobilise trillions of dollars when it really wants to. But at COP26, some of you might not realise that the fossil fuel lobbyists were the largest delegate group at the COP26 meeting. So
bigger than any country.
Bigger than any other country.
First Nations were the second.
But that just goes to show that there are still these forces at play that are really paralysing true global change on this issue. But if we wanted to do it, we could absolutely do it.
I'm going to take one more quick question here. And then I'm also going to remind you that Jeff and Joelle are signing books after this, so you're welcome to come up and have a chat to them then. And I'm sure Tish will hang around if anyone wants to chat, and I'll be here too. So
I'll
sign. She'll sign anything. So as will I. We'll just sign whatever comes near us. So come and have a chat afterwards if you'd still like to talk. Sorry, over here. Yeah.
I would love to hear your thoughts about pushing past. You talk about the way that we used to reject what is now a norm, whether that be plastic bags or what have you, but that now people feel so strongly about or hold really deeply to as part of tradition. And that goes or moves into protecting certain factors or areas of biodiversity that might impact people's current ways of life. There's a feeling in corporations, organisations, politics, sometimes in media, where we have to listen to those voices and cater to those voices as well, despite the impacts, the negative impacts that that tradition currently might continue to have. What would be your advice there in breaking through that?
I mean, look, that's a huge issue. I know, I'm aware that we're out of time, but I think one of the things that's tremendously important is that we learn to fight and we have a strategic orientation to winning. And by fighting, I'm not talking about, you know, bombs or guns. I mean, the thing I think that we could all take away is learning how to argue with people, learning how to persuade people, learning how to tell people respectfully, I think you are wrong and here are the reasons. Not necessarily dismissing them, but not just accepting positions that are wrong, trying to win them to these movements and organisations that we're setting up. If we really are committed to mass social change, that means convincing your neighbour, that means convincing your workmate, that means going out and finding the ways to persuade other people. And that's a question of practice. That's a skill set that we need to learn.
Thank you. I hope you could all join me in applauding our wonderful panellists. Thank you very much for coming, everyone here, and feel free to come up and have a chat afterwards, and please come and buy a book and sign them, and we'll get them signed. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This series was recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners of the land on which we work. We pay our respects to the people of the Kulin Nation and all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders past and present. If you enjoyed this discussion and would like to support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.